So welcome back to the Nez Marsh Show. This is Nicholas Hotshot. I'm opinion editor of Newsweek magazine, and I'm standing in for Leslie, who is enjoying a well-deserved break. And we've got a thank you very much, by the way, to Taylor Wofford, who held up that first half hour, and also for Dave calling in from Humboldt County. Now we've got a very interesting guy called Daniel Beer, who's the editor of the Anything Peaceful blog at the Foundation for Economic Education. And he wrote a very interesting piece, which ran on their site, but also ran on Newsweek.com. And it's about the death penalty, which has suddenly come into the news again. You would have thought that nothing much changes in terms of attitudes to death penalty. But Daniel, maybe you just bring us up to date on where we were. Things have been moving, haven't they?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Nicholas. We've actually reached a historic low in support for capital punishment, at least in the United States in recent history. In 1995, support for the death penalty among the public at large was about 6-1 in favor of using the death penalty on violent criminals, usually murderers and other severe crimes, and it has dropped substantially since the mid 90s at the peak of the crime wave, and now we're all the way down to support for capital punishment being only 2-1. About 66% of the country currently supports the death penalty, and so that's the support is still overwhelming, but the trend is definitely down.
And how would you explain this? Is there any issues, any events that have changed this, or is it just demographic? The fact is that maybe older people used to hold on to certainties in the way that younger people are just more generous about these things. What's your explanation?
Well, I'd say that my explanation is that it's probably due to the drop in crime. Over the last two decades, we've seen the murder rate and the violent crime rate overall drop by about half since its peak in the early 1990s. As crime becomes something that happens to other people rather than something that people see every day, support for the death penalty goes down. I mean, I'm sure there's many other things that are going on, but I have to think that the decline in violent crime and property crime in the United States, the massive and underreported decline in crime, has to be driving a lot of this shift in public opinion.
And you suggest in your fine piece that maybe those who oppose the death penalty have sort of moral qualms about it. That is, that they don't think that the state ought to take human life in any form and that so-called punishment should be left to God. Whereas on the other side, people think that they're looking for real punishment. The fact is, you know, an eye for an eye stuff. It's very sort of Old Testament, which part of the Ten Commandments versus an eye for an eye wins out.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the time when we talk about the death penalty, we hear people debating, you know, how much it costs, and it is very costly, or whether it deters crime, you know, these sort of utilitarian explanations about what we can accomplish by using the death penalty or what it costs us to use the death penalty. But I think that this is actually kind of a red herring, because most of the support and most of the opposition to the death penalty comes from moral considerations about whether it's just wrong to take a life when you don't have to, or whether it's about retribution against people who have it coming. You know, people who took life deserve to lose their own lives. And this is the overwhelming majority of the support for the death penalty comes from these sort of biblical or retributive ideas of retributive justice. You know, they deserve it. They have it coming.
Absolutely. It's interesting, isn't it, that in Western Europe, which is not such a dissimilar civilization to American civilization, they've long ago abandoned the death penalty. In fact, if you're a member of the European Union, you may not use the death penalty, to the extent that even if you have a terrorist, a known terrorist, you may not extradite them to the United States lest they be executed here. So it's sort of it's an interesting twist, isn't it, on this, that the Europeans are, would you say, ahead of us in this? I mean, do you think the pendulum is going to move one way and then never come back, which is what happened in Europe?
It certainly doesn't look like that. You know, if we saw some sort of sort of dramatic reversal in crime rates, I think that you would probably see an uptick in support for the death penalty. But the trend over the last, you know, a few decades and even longer than that is towards abolishing the death penalty. It started, you know, all over Europe in the latter half of the 20th century and in some places before that. And in the United States, you know, 18 states have now abolished the death penalty. And a lot of the states that technically have it just choose not to exercise it. And, you know, public opinion has been strongly shifting away from support for execution. So I think that, you know, that really is where we're headed. I can't fully explain the difference between the United States and Western Europe. I think part of it is cultural and religious. The United States is a more religious country. You know, there is some correlation between religiosity and support for the death penalty, with the exception of some denominations like Catholics, who are strongly anti-death penalty, and many of the people that I work with are strongly religious, but are actually opposed to the death penalty because of their beliefs. But we do seem to be moving in that direction, where we are finding, you know, fewer and fewer good reasons to continue executions, and stronger reasons to get rid of it. And so it seems to be just a ratchet that works in one direction. Once states abolish the death penalty, they're very unlikely to bring it back.
Yeah. So just to remind you that we're talking to, my name is Nicholas Wapshot. I'm the opinion editor of Newsweek, standing in for Leslie Marshall on the Leslie Marshall Show. Daniel Beer is the editor of the Anything Peaceful blog at the Foundation for Economic Education, which I recommend to you. Always original thoughts, always fresh thoughts make you think again, even about topics that you thought that you settled your views on. So, Daniel, thank you very much for that. What do you make of the Supreme Court, who are having to decide any minute about whether the means of committing the death penalty is a cruel and unnecessary punishment under the Constitution? As you know, there have been a great number of miserable deaths, protracted deaths, with using chemicals in order to inject into people to kill them, and that some of these have gone on for many, many minutes. I mean, plainly, the person is writhing in agony. What do you think the Supreme Court's going to say about that in the end?
You know, predicting the Supreme Court is just a fool's errand. You know, it's a mug's game. What you're talking about is very interesting, because we've gotten to a point now where lethal injection is the most popular, which is kind of a morbid idea, a most popular way to kill people in this country. If you're going to have the death penalty in your state, people prefer that it be through lethal injection, this cocktail of drugs that, you know, first paralyzes the person and then kills them. However, it sort of has this sort of clinical feel, you know, like this is a medical procedure. You strap people down, you stick an IV into their arm, and then they just sort of fade away, or that's the idea, except that, you know, the drugs that they use, there is no longer any legitimate source for the cocktail of drugs that are most commonly used for lethal injections. Activists have pressured drug companies to stop supplying this drug to states to kill people with under ethical concerns. And so states have turned to essentially the black market. They are going around and purchasing these drugs on the black market so that they can continue to execute people with them. And this raises all sorts of legal and ethical and constitutional concerns. The response of some states has been to pass laws which create official secrecy around the source and the kinds of the drugs that are being used to kill people. Which is, you're not even allowed to know how people are dying. And so it's kind of hard to know, well, is this actually going to kill someone if you give this to them, or is it just going to torture them for hours and hours and hours, which is what has happened in some states.
Yeah, when the, so, when the,
Yeah, when the state gets into, or any state gets into a position where it's killing people without explaining exactly how it's doing it, we're right on the edge of a Kafka-like territory. Anyway, we're going to come back to this subject very shortly, after a couple of minutes. Daniel, just stay on the line, and we'll see the other side of the break.
Leslie Marshall, real people, real life, real talk. 888-6-LESLIE.
Okay, welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is I'm the opinion editor of Newsweek magazine, and I have with me Daniel Beer, who is a great blogger, Anything Peaceful blog at the Foundation for Economic Education. And we're talking about the death penalty. If you're tuned in for Leslie Marshall, she's enjoying a well-earned vacation. You've got me instead. And so, Daniel, you raised some interesting things in your fine article about the death penalty, because we've just been talking about the moral difficulties on one side or the other. Both sides take different stances on this. But there are good practical reasons, aren't there, why it turns out it's a very rash thing to take somebody's life.
I'd say that that's a bit of an understatement, actually, particularly when the stakes are so grave. So a lot of the time when we talk about the death penalty, we're talking about how much it costs or whether it deters crime. But in reality, most people either support or oppose the death penalty because of their moral beliefs, whether it's wrong to take a life or whether some people deserve to die. And I think that there's actually a way to get around this, you know, sort of just intractable conflict of, well, I believe this and I believe that. And there's a simple way that we can all come to an agreement on this, which is that we all agree, even if some people deserve to die, innocent people, it's very, very important that the state not kill innocent people. And since the death penalty was re-legalized by the Supreme Court in 1976, the United States has executed over 1,400 people. But meanwhile, over 152 people have been exonerated and released from death row. So that means that we are, you know, our batting average here is not very high. You know, we are executing 10 people for every one innocent person that we sentence to death. And so that, you know, that means that for every 10 people we're executing, we're letting one walk free from death row because he was wrongfully convicted. And that is, you know, I think that it's just inconceivable to believe that all of those 1,400 people that we have executed, they were all innocent. I mean, that they were all guilty, that we know absolutely, so confidently that we are willing to take a life. And so I think that there's just a way around this sort of intractable moral question, which is that practically, who gets to decide who lives and dies? Even if some people do deserve to die, should we trust our criminal justice system to find out who that is? And we have found out 152 times in the last three decades that the criminal justice system got it wrong, that they sent people to die who were innocent. And I think that should get people's attention, regardless of their moral beliefs about, you know, an eye for an eye or whether some people do deserve to die.
That makes absolute sense to me, I must say. There have been recent cases, haven't there? Maybe tell us a bit about the Brooklyn guy who was convicted of murder, but the judge ordered his release, having spent 20 years in prison because of what the judge called deeply flawed detective work. Tell us a bit about that case.
So there was a case last month in New York City where a man was convicted of murder. And sentenced to he was not sentenced to death, but he was convicted of murder, and he was ordered released by a judge after 20 years in prison, more than 20 years in prison, because of what she called deeply flawed detective work that undermines our judicial system. And this was the result of – he was actually the sixth person so far that has been released from prison as a result of this one detective in the NYPD who is alleged to have fabricated confessions and fixed lineups, basically told witnesses who to pick out of a police lineup, and then used the witness identification in order to get a conviction. Or reported that the suspect confessed under interrogation, and then the suspect later denied ever having said anything to him, but on his word alone that there was a confession, people were sent to prison, and so this has all come out in the last few years, and there have been dozens of murder investigations that have been reopened as a result of just this one person who made. Or who is alleged to have made some very serious ethical breaches. And so can you imagine if this man had been sentenced to death as a result of being declared a murderer based on this one person's detective work, if he had been sentenced to death, he very likely would have been killed by now. And there's no undoing that. There's no way to go back. There's no way to compensate someone for that. That is the most severe punishment that can be inflicted by the state. And we have good reason to believe that our criminal justice system is just not good enough to, you know, get it right 100% of the time. And, you know, soon after that, there was a man in Alabama who was convicted of murder and sentenced to die on the basis of extremely flawed forensic testimony, and he was released after 30 years in prison. But you know, as terrible as it is to have sent an innocent man to prison for 30 years on the basis of lousy CSI, you know, it would be infinitely worse to have killed him, which is what a lot of death penalty advocates say we should be doing faster. Every time we bring up the cost of the death penalty, which is it's extremely expensive to kill people because of all the appeals. You know, California has spent $4 billion in the last 3 decades to execute just 13 people. And so death penalty advocates say, well, we should just be executing them faster. Well, we've seen people exonerated 10, 20, 30 years after their convictions and sentences. And you know, I just don't think that being more hasty about killing people is the answer to what's wrong with the death penalty.
And there are other dimensions to this, aren't there? Apparently, there are 3,000 people awaiting execution in America at the moment. They are predominantly African Americans, aren't they?
Disproportionately so, yes.
Disproportionately so, yeah, which can't help. I mean, you know, if we have racial tensions in this country, which we do, just look at Baltimore regularly through the last year, the tensions are just below the surface. The fact that there is a disproportionate racial tinge to the ultimate penalty, it can't help.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. And there is a Supreme Court case, not terribly well known, called McCluskey versus Kemp in 1987, and in which the Supreme Court ruled that Georgia's application of the death penalty didn't violate the equal protection rights under the Constitution of the people who were sentenced to death. Despite admitting that racism very clearly played a substantial role in determining who received the death penalty, by admitting that, you know, if a black defendant, and particularly a black defendant who killed a white person or is accused to have killed a white person, is far more likely to be sentenced to death than the reverse.
Absolutely. Just hold on a minute, Daniel. We've got John, who's from New York City, who's called in. He wants to make a point. John, what's your point?
I think it's really hard to not look at information these days. Back in 1995, when, you know, this stuff was going on, it was harder to obtain information. People were still using antiquated ways. Now we've got all the information in the world in our phones. So if you have a certain kind of critical mindset, you can look up these things, and you know, it's a lot easier to be well-informed now than it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, very good point. Very crisp point, too, for which I'm most grateful, because we are coming to the end of this segment. Daniel, thank you very much indeed. First of all, for writing this great piece. Thank you for articulating it so clearly to our listeners. And let's hope we may have you back on again on another day. Thank you very much indeed. That's Daniel Beer from the Foundation for Economic Education.